variable production of entropy in the form of waste products and dissipative forces that cause physical damage. As we begin to lose the multiple localized battles against entropy, we age, ultimately losing the war and succumbing to death. Entropy kills. Or, as the great Russian playwright Anton Chekhov poignantly remarked, only entropy comes easy. A central feature of how life is sustained is the transportation of metabolic energy through space-filling networks across all scales to service and feed cells, mitochondria, respiratory complexes, genomes, and other functional intracellular units. However, these very systems that sustain us are continually causing damage and degrading our bodies. Just as the flows of cars and trucks on highways or the flow of water through pipes lead to continuous wear and tear, resulting in damage and decay, so it is with the flows in our networks. However, there is a crucial difference. In organisms, the damage with the most serious consequences occurs at the cellular and intracellular levels, which are terminal units of these networks where energy and resources are exchanged. As, for instance, between capillaries and cells. Damage occurs across multiple scales through many different mechanisms associated with physical or chemical transport phenomena, but loosely speaking, it can be separated into two categories. 1. Classic physical wear and tear due to the viscous drag in the flow, analogous to the wear and tear resulting from ordinary friction when two physical objects move over each other, like wearing out your shoes or the tires of your car. 2. Chemical damage from free radicals, which are the byproducts of the production of ATP in respiratory metabolism. A free radical is any atom or molecule that has lost an electron and consequently has a positive electric charge, making it highly volatile. Most of this kind of damage is caused by oxygen radicals that react with vital cellular components. Oxidative damage to DNA may be particularly deleterious, because in non-replicating cells, such as in the brain and musculature, it causes permanent damage to transcriptional, and perhaps most important, regulatory regions of the genome. Although the detailed role and extent of oxidative damage in aging remains unclear, it has stimulated a mini-industry of antioxidant supplements such as vitamin E, fish oil, and red wine, as some of those elixirs of life to combat aging. The great power and virtue of having a general quantitative theory for understanding the structure and dynamics of these networks, and in particular for the energetic flows through them, is that it provides an analytic framework for calculating many other subsidiary quantities, such as the growth curves in the previous section and damage rates relevant to aging and mortality that I am going to discuss here. This coarse-grained framework is very general and can incorporate any model of aging based on generalizations of damage mechanisms associated with generalized physical or chemical transport phenomena discussed above. The details of the damage mechanism are not important for understanding many of the general features of aging and mortality, because the most relevant damage occurs in invariant terminal units of networks, capillaries and mitochondria, for example, whose properties do not appreciably change with the size of the organism. Consequently, the damage per capillary or mitochondrion is approximately the same, regardless of the animal. Because these networks are space-filling, meaning that they service all cells and mitochondria throughout the body of the organism, damage occurs approximately uniformly and relentlessly throughout the organism, explaining why aging is approximately spatially uniform and progresses approximately linearly with age. This is why at age 75, every part of your body has deteriorated to pretty much the same degree. At a more detailed level, This implies that aging within each organ is approximately uniform, even though different organs may age at moderately different rates, because they have slightly different network characteristics, especially in regard to their potential for repair. Because larger animals metabolize at higher rates, following the three-quarters power scaling law, they suffer greater production of entropy, and therefore greater overall damage. So, you might have thought that this would imply that larger animals would have shorter lifespans, in obvious contradiction to observation. However, we saw in Chapter 3 that on a cellular or per unit mass of tissue basis, metabolic rate and therefore the rate at which damage is occurring at the cellular and intracellular levels decreases systematically with increasing size of the animal. Another expression of economy of scale. Furthermore, as already emphasized, the most significant damage occurs at the terminal units of networks in capillaries, mitochondria, and cells, and their metabolic rates decrease with the size of the organism following power law scaling with an exponent of 1/4. Cells in larger animals are systematically processing energy at a slower rate than cells in smaller ones. So, at the critical cellular level, cells suffer systematically less damage at a slower rate the larger the animal, and this results in a correspondingly longer lifespan. Recall that this downregulation of terminal units is a result of the hegemony of the network, and is the origin of the general economy of scale with increasing size. This is also reflected in the number of terminal units increasing only as the 3/4 power of mass, rather than linearly. This played a crucial role in deriving growth curves and for explaining why growth eventually ceases. Because terminal units are invariant, the total damage rate is just proportional to their total number, and so also increases only as the 3/4 power of mass, and is therefore directly proportional to metabolic rate. Driven by metabolism, the accumulation of damage relentlessly degrades the entire organism. To combat this continual damage, our bodies have potent repair mechanisms, which are also powered by cellular metabolism and therefore constrained by the same networks and scaling laws. Consequently, their inclusion in the calculation of the total amount of irreversible damage does not change the mathematical structure of the equation, but does, of course, affect its overall magnitude. Repair is expensive, and faithfully repairing every single damage event is prohibitively expensive, if not impossible, given the enormous number of damages that are continually occurring. The overall scale of repair is primarily determined by the evolutionary requirement that organisms live long enough to produce sufficient offspring to compete in the gene pool. Aging, therefore, progresses approximately uniformly, gradually leading to the onset of mortality. This is the result of cumulative unrepaired damage having become sufficiently macroscopic that the functionality of the organism is increasingly compromised. Ultimately, the organism is no longer able to function, resulting in death from old age. A small fluctuation or perturbation, such as a mild heart flutter, is sufficient to end viability. In most cases, however, death occurs earlier than this, from multiple causes related to the weakening of specific organs and, or the immune and cardiovascular systems, for example, because of the accumulation of damage in them. All of the dominant causes of mortality fall under this umbrella, except, of course, death arising from externalities and deleterious environmental conditions, such as accidents, firearms, and pollutants. Consequently, a calculation of lifespan based on the origins of death that I've outlined actually sets a limit on maximum possible lifespan. This can be estimated assuming that the ultimate threshold for death is reached when the fraction of damaged cells, or molecules, such as DNA, relative to the total number in the organ or body, reaches a critical value, which is approximately the same for all organisms of the same taxonomic group, all mammals, for example. In other words, the total number of damages is proportional to the total number of cells, and therefore to the body mass. We simply ask how long it takes for this number of damages to have happened, knowing from the metabolic rate the rate at which damage is occurring, and that, on average, each cellular damage event is caused by approximately the same invariant amount of energy. The total number of damages incurred in a lifetime is just the damage rate. That is, the number of damage events per unit time, which is proportional to the number of terminal units, multiplied by the lifespan. And this has to be proportional to the total number of cells, and therefore to body mass. Consequently, lifespan is proportional to the total number of cells divided by the number of terminal units. But the number of terminal units scales with mass with a 3/4 power exponent, while the number of cells scales linearly, resulting in lifespan scaling as the quarter power of mass, consistent with data. Notice that just as we saw when discussing growth, the mismatch between the scaling of the sources of energy, and therefore the sources of damage, the terminal units, and the scaling of the sinks of energy, cells that need to be sustained, has enormous consequences. In the one case, it ensures that we cease growing, and in the other, it ensures that larger animals have expanded lifetimes. And all of this follows from the constraint of the networks. 5. Tests, predictions, and consequences. Extending lifespan. A. Temperature and extending lifespan. Because metabolic rate is proportional to the number of terminal units, and these are where most damage occurs, we can relate lifespan directly to metabolic rate. This results in an alternative expression for lifespan as the ratio of the body mass to its metabolic rate. In other words, lifespan is inversely proportional to the metabolic rate per unit mass of the organism, and therefore inversely proportional to the average metabolic rate of its cells. We saw just above, when discussing the metabolic theory of ecology, that this systematically scales with body mass, following quarter power scaling, and as an exponential with temperature. This provides an interesting test of the theory, by explaining why lifespans systematically and predictably increase exponentially as temperature decreases. This implies that lifespan can, in principle, be extended by lowering the body temperature, because this lowers cellular metabolic rate, and therefore the rate at which damage is incurred. This is a very large effect. I remind you that a modest 2 degrees centigrade decrease in body temperature can result in a 20% to 30% increase in lifespan. So, if you were able to artificially lower your body temperature by just 1 degree centigrade, that's about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, you could enhance your lifespan by about 10% to 15%. The hitch is that you would have to do this for your entire life in order to reap the benefits. But, more saliently, significantly lowering body temperature may well have many other deleterious, potentially life-threatening outcomes. As I have stressed earlier, changing just one component of a complex adaptive system without fully understanding its multi-level spatio-temporal dynamics usually leads to unintended consequences. B. Heartbeats and the pace of life. These data also confirm the approximate 1/4 power scaling of lifespans with mass. Because the theory for the cardiovascular system predicts that heart rates decrease with a 1/4 power of mass, the dependence on mass cancels out when we multiply heart rates by lifespans. The decrease in one exactly compensates for the increase in the other, resulting in an invariant, a quantity that's the same for all mammals. But multiplying heart rates by lifespans just gives the total number of heartbeats in a lifetime. So, the theory predicts that this should be the same for all mammals, consistent with the data shown in Chapter 1. This argument can be extended to the fundamental level of the respiratory complexes, the basic units inside mitochondria where ATP is manufactured, to show that the number of times the reaction takes place producing ATP is the same for all mammals. As I have already remarked, large animals live long lives slowly, whereas small ones live short lives fast, but in such a way that their biomarkers, such as the total number of times their hearts beat, remain approximately the same. When rescaled according to a quarter power scaling, the life history events of all mammals collapse to the same trajectory. Maybe all mammals experience the sequence, pace, and longevity of life as being pretty much the same. A lovely thought. Once upon a time, when we were just another mammal, we did too. With the coming of social communities and urbanization, we evolved into something different, substantially deviating from the constraints that kept us in harmony with nature. Our effective metabolic rate has increased 100-fold. So, we've doubled our lifespan and diminished our fecundity. I'll return to discuss these extraordinary changes in later chapters, using the same conceptual framework to understand how this happened. C. Caloric restriction and extending lifespan. We just saw that lifespan decreases inversely with cellular metabolic rate. Because this systematically decreases with increasing mass across animals, less damage is incurred per cell, resulting in larger animals living longer. However, within species, an individual like each of us can decrease its cellular metabolic rate simply by eating less, resulting in less metabolic damage per cell, and potentially in an increase in its lifespan. This strategy is called caloric restriction. It has a long, somewhat controversial history, and has been the focus of many studies across a range of animals. Many of these have shown significant benefits, but others have found little effect, and the situation remains a bit murky. Almost all of the investigations show some signs of decreased aging, whether or not lifespan is enhanced. It's difficult to carry out long-term controlled experiments, and impossible to execute them on human beings, and many of these studies suffer from poor design. I am somewhat biased toward them because I believe in the theory and the concept that lowering metabolism decreases damage, slows the aging process, and increases maximum lifespan. Roughly speaking, the theory predicts that maximum lifespan, and by extrapolation average lifespan, increases inversely with caloric intake. Taken at face value, the theory predicts that if you consistently decrease your food intake by 10%, a couple of hundred calories a day, you could live for up to 10% longer, up to 10 years more. Data was gathered on caloric restriction from experiments on mice performed in the 1980s by Roy Walford, who was a pathologist at the UCLA School of Medicine and the leading advocate of caloric restriction for extending lifespan. The data are presented in the form of survival curves for cohorts of mice under different levels of food intake. The effects are indeed dramatic and are consistent with the prediction of a 10% increase in lifespan resulting from a 10% caloric restriction, but actually show a smaller effect than the predicted doubling of lifespan resulting from a massive halving of the caloric intake. Lifespan increased by about 75% rather than the predicted 100%. However, The trends and general shape of the relationship between lifespan and caloric intake are consistent with the theory. Given the relative simplicity of the theory, the agreement is surprisingly good. Coupled with the success of its other predictions, including the rate of aging, the allometric scaling of lifespan, and its temperature dependence, the theory provides a credible, coarse-grained baseline for developing a more detailed, quantitative theory for understanding aging and mortality. It gives formulae for the rate of aging and maximum lifespan in terms of generic, universal biological parameters that show, for instance, how the scale of 100 years arises from microscopic molecular scales, and why mice live for only a very few years. This provides the scientific basis for asking questions about what parameters can be manipulated to extend life and arrest aging, if that is the goal. For example, combining the scaling laws with data on lifespans gives quantitative estimates of how long life can be extended by changing body temperature or eating less. Furthermore, because this theory is just one piece of a much larger unified framework integrating much of life history, it can also help address the crucial question of what some of the unintended consequences of manipulating lifespan might be. Naively trying to intervene in the natural processes of aging and mortality, whether genetically, physically, or by magic potions, could, and in fact does, have potential deleterious consequences for health and lifestyle. Without a quantitative theoretical framework, such manipulations are potentially dangerous and irresponsible. Before completing this section, I would be remiss not to mention that Roy Walford, who played a seminal role in aging research, was a man of many talents. Among his many exploits, he gained a certain early notoriety when he and a fellow graduate student used statistical analysis to determine which roulette wheels at a casino in Reno, Nevada, were accidentally biased. By betting heavily on the ones that were most unbalanced, they cleaned up. The casinos eventually realized what was happening and banned them from betting. From his winnings, Walford funded his medical school education, as well as a year of sailing a yacht in the Caribbean. Chapter 5. From the Anthropocene to the Urbanocene. A planet dominated by cities. 1. Living in exponentially expanding universes. One of the most startling and profound discoveries of the 20th century was to learn that, on the cosmic scale, we are living in an exponentially expanding universe. An equally profound, but much less heralded discovery was the realization that on the earthly scale, we are also living in an exponentially expanding universe, this one socio-economic. Although it hardly grabs the same kind of attention, this accelerating socio-economic expansion has had, and will continue to have, a significantly more profound effect on your life, your children's lives, and their children's lives, than all the wonders and paradoxes of the exponentially expanding cosmic universe and its archetypal mythologies of dark matter, dark energy, and the Big Bang. The most obvious manifestation of the exponential rate at which our social and economic lives have been expanding is provided by the huge population explosion that has occurred over the past 200 years or so. After 2 million years of slow, steady growth, the number of human beings living on the planet is estimated to have eventually reached the billion mark around 1805. But, following the Industrial Revolution, the world's population exploded. The transition can be characterized as a shift from traditional hand production to massive industrial machinery and factory production. To a large extent, it was stimulated by the invention of large-scale manufacturing processes, fueled by the discovery of new methodologies for exploiting the energy stored in huge iron and coal deposits. The subsequent access to apparently unlimited energy and human resources engendered by the rise of capitalism and individual and corporate entrepreneurship and innovation, marked a major transition in human affairs. The Industrial Revolution was the socio-economic equivalent of the Big Bang. Having taken 2 million years to reach a population of 1 billion, the next billion took only another 120 years, and the one after that took less than 35. Doubling that took just 25 years, reaching 4 billion in 1974, and, at present only 42 years later, we have almost doubled that again, with a global population now in excess of 7.3 billion people. Thus, until quite recently, doubling time has been systematically decreasing, reflecting a faster than exponential growth. Just this year alone, we are adding another 80 million, the equivalent of an entire Germany or a Turkey, and are on track to reach a possible 12 billion at the beginning of the next century. The first pictures of the whole Earth taken from space were inspirational in giving us a completely new psychological perspective on who we are, where we came from, and what sustains us. It was a startling revelation to see a photograph of one's mother for the first time, the one that has given birth to all 7.3 billion of us, bathed in the glorious light of our grandparent, the sun. At the time, perhaps no one appreciated this more than the writer and futurist thinker Stuart Brand, who passionately felt that the image of the whole Earth from space would be a powerful symbol, evoking a sense of shared destiny among all people living on the planet. He relentlessly lobbied NASA to release the first images in 1967, which he then used on the cover of his highly influential Whole Earth catalogue, one of the great icons of the 1960s and 70s. Equally revelatory are the more recent pictures of Mother Earth taken at night when she is not bathed in sunlight. Had it been technically possible to take such a photograph a couple of hundred years ago, it would have appeared black and revealed nothing. Even 50 years ago, it would have looked relatively dim. Not so today. Now we have spectacular pictures taken by NASA satellites showing the Earth covered in what looks like a magnificent filigree web of glistening Christmas lights. The brilliance of these night lights is, of course, the explicit result of the exponential population explosion and the extraordinary technical and economic achievements that have accompanied it. And, overwhelmingly, these lights are generated by cities, reflecting the bewildering rate at which we have been urbanizing. As a symbol of 21st century Homo sapiens, it encapsulates the very essence of the concept of the urbanocene and of scale. Our recent global population explosion is truly an astonishing achievement, especially when it is realized that, despite huge pockets of poverty, the overall quality of life as measured by health, longevity, and income has by and large increased in concert with this growth when averaged across the entire globe. Traditionally, population growth correlates with increasing socio-economic and financial indices, so much so that we not only take exponential expansion for granted, but have effectively raised it to an axiom. Our entire social and economic paradigm is geared to the continued drive to sustain open-ended, exponential growth. Furthermore, the 7.3 billion of us already on board, and the several billion that will soon be joining us over the coming decades, need to be fed, clothed, educated, and cared for. Almost all of us want houses, cars, and smartphones. We want to be entertained with televisions, videos, and films in comfortable surroundings. And many of us want to travel and to have access to education and the internet. Regardless of the diversity of our actions, material desires, and well-being, we all want to have meaningful and fulfilling lives. Together, we make up the fantastic tapestry of life, all contributing, participating, benefiting, and suffering to varying degrees from the variety of social and economic processes that human beings have invented. But none of this has happened, nor can it be sustained, without a continuous supply of energy and resources. As presently constituted, our continued success requires the supply of coal, gas, oil, fresh water, iron, copper, molybdenum, titanium, ruthenium, platinum, phosphorus, nitrogen, and much, much more to be available at an exponentially increasing rate. 2. Cities, urbanization, and global sustainability. Perhaps our greatest invention has been the very stage upon which this panoply of socio-economic interactions, mechanisms, and processes that drive exponential expansion has been played out, namely the city. This is the view expressed by the urban economist Edward Glaser in his book The Triumph of the City. For concomitant with the population explosion over the past 200 years has been the exponential urbanization of the planet. The city is the ingenious mechanism we have evolved for facilitating and enhancing social interaction and collaboration, two necessary components of successful innovation and wealth creation. Population and urban growth are, of course, very closely interrelated, each feeding on the other, resulting in our extraordinary dominance of the planet. The term Anthropocene has been suggested as the name for this most recent epoch in the history of our planet, during which human activities have significantly affected the Earth's ecosystems. This process began more than 10,000 years ago with the discovery of agriculture and the subsequent transition from mobile hunter-gatherers to sedentary communities, and eventually to the emergence of the first cities. Up until that time, we were still predominantly biological, meaning that we were an integrated component of the Earth's multifaceted ecology, just another mammal, so to speak, in meta-equilibrium with all of the other creatures and organisms that comprise the seemingly unbounded diversity of nature. Accordingly, our global population was then just a few million people, reflecting our dynamic interrelationship with the natural environment, and the Earth was still fundamentally pristine. But eventually along came the Industrial Revolution. Although much of the Earth's landscape had already been significantly modified by human activities prior to its coming, this dramatic series of unprecedented events heralded the beginning of a profound transition to a state of explosive, faster than exponential expansion that has led to unforeseen changes in the planet's ecology, environment, and climate over an astonishingly short period. Consequently, some have proposed that we should date the beginnings of the Anthropocene from the Industrial Revolution, while others suggest it should be as recent as the middle of the 20th century. Others have even suggested that it began more than 10,000 years ago, coinciding with the beginning of the Holocene, the geological epoch that began when the Earth warmed up, leading to the development of agriculture and modern man. I am very enthusiastic about explicitly acknowledging our profound impact on the planet by naming a new epoch, but would prefer that we reserve Anthropocene for the entire period, going back several thousand years to when we first began to significantly diverge from being predominantly biological to becoming predominantly social by increasing our effective metabolic rate. In that spirit, we should also acknowledge that we have already made a sharp transition out of the purely Anthropocene to what could be considered yet another epoch characterized by the exponential rise of cities which now dominate the planet. To designate this much shorter and intense period that began with the Industrial Revolution, I would like to introduce a new term and suggest the name Urbanocene. Given how profound this change has been, and that its future dynamic will determine whether this amazing socio-economic enterprise will continue to prosper, or whether it is destined to decay and die, I want to set the scene by repeating some of what I wrote in the opening chapter. As we move into the 21st century, cities and global urbanization have emerged as the source of the greatest challenges the planet has faced since humans became social. The future of humanity and the long-term sustainability of the planet are inextricably linked to the fate of our cities. Cities are the crucible of civilization, the hubs of innovation, the engines of wealth creation and centers of power, the magnets that attract creative individuals, and the stimulant for ideas, growth, and innovation. But they also have a dark side. They are the prime loci of crime, pollution, poverty, disease, and the consumption of energy and resources. Rapid urbanization and accelerating socio-economic development have generated multiple global challenges, ranging from climate change and its environmental impacts to incipient crises in food, energy, and water availability, public health, financial markets, and the global economy. Given this dual nature of cities as, on the one hand, the origin of our major challenges, and on the other, the generator of creativity and ideas, and therefore the source of their solutions, it becomes a matter of some urgency to ask whether there can be a science of cities, by which I mean a conceptual framework for understanding their dynamics, growth, and evolution in a quantitatively predictable framework. This is crucial for devising a serious strategy for achieving long-term sustainability, especially given that the overwhelming majority of human beings will be urban dwellers by the second half of this century, many in megacities of unprecedented size. None of the problems, challenges, and threats we are facing is new. All of them have been with us since at least the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. Urbanization is a relatively new global phenomenon, which was not perceived as serious until very recently because cities were very much subdominant relative to the total population. It is only because of the exponential rate of urbanization that the problems they create have now begun to feel like an impending tsunami with the potential to overwhelm us. 50 years ago, even 15 years ago, most of us weren't conscious of global warming, long-term environmental changes, limitations on energy, water, and other resources, health and pollution issues, and the stability of financial markets. And if we were, we presumed they were temporary aberrations that would eventually disappear. This is certainly open to debate, with most politicians, economists, and policymakers taking a fairly optimistic view that our ingenuity will triumph. It is in the very nature of an exponential that the future becomes the present at an increasingly more rapid pace, so much so that by the time a problem has arisen, it's often too late to address it successfully. Given the general attitude toward this silent threat of exponential expansion, I want to digress and explain its implications, because few in power and policy seem to appreciate it. 3. Digression. What exactly is an exponential anyway? Some cautionary fables. In discussing the expansion of the universe since the Big Bang, or the huge socio-economic changes that have taken place on the planet since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, I have been using the phrases exponential growth and exponential expansion, assuming they are well-understood terms. Indeed, I have invoked exponential somewhat cavalierly, without carefully explaining what it means and what it implies. I may well be underestimating the knowledge and understanding of the general public, but it is not unusual to hear the word exponential being used by well-educated journalists, media gurus, politicians, and corporate leaders in ways that indicate that they do not fully understand its meaning or appreciate its formidable implications. In fact, I often feel that if they did, we would have a much easier time convincing them of the urgent need to think carefully and strategically about the challenges of long-term sustainability. So, at the risk of being pedantic, And because the concept is so important and plays such a critical role in the book, I want to make a short detour to elaborate on its meaning and implications. Exponential is another one of those technical words like momentum or quantum that originated in a scientific context with a precisely defined meaning, but have entered the common jargon because they connote a useful concept that is not already adequately communicated in our everyday language. Colloquially, the phrase growing exponentially is generally understood to convey the idea of very fast growth. For example, in my dictionary, the first meaning ascribed to exponential is rapid growth. In actuality, exponential growth starts out rather slowly, even innocuously, before smoothly transitioning to what might be termed rapid growth. But it's much more than that. A population that is growing exponentially is defined mathematically as one in which the rate of increase in its size, per minute, per day, or per year, for instance, is directly proportional to the size of the population that's already there. Thus, the growth rate itself grows even faster the bigger the population. So, for example, when the size of a population undergoing exponential growth doubles, the rate at which it is increasing also doubles, which means that it grows faster and faster the bigger it gets, effectively feeding back and running away with itself. Left unchecked, both the population and its growth rate would eventually become infinitely large. You're quite familiar with this kind of growth in your daily life, even though it's not usually referred to as exponential growth. For an equivalent way of saying that the rate of increase per unit time is directly proportional to what's currently there is to say that the relative or percentage growth rate is constant, which sounds quite innocuous. This is none other than classic compound interest, used by banks for calculating the rate of return on your investments. So when presidents, finance ministers, prime ministers, and CEOs announce that their countries or organizations are growing at a rate of 5% this year, or when your bank tells you that the rate of return on your savings is 5%, implicit in what they are saying is that these are growing exponentially, and that the absolute growth rate next year is going to be 5% larger than it was this year. So, if nothing changes, everybody gets progressively richer and more prosperous. Even when the president grimly announces that the economy only grew at 1.5% this quarter and gets a lot of negative feedback that the economy is sluggish, he is still implying that the economy grew exponentially and that we are still on track to grow faster and faster the bigger we get, just at a slower rate. Under a constant percentage growth rate, everybody is still getting richer and more prosperous. So no wonder we are hooked on the open-ended steroid-like exponential growth drug. It is truly a real high and is an explicit manifestation of the huge success of our economic dynamic. The growth of a system, whether an economy or a population, is often expressed in terms of a quantity called the doubling time, which is simply the time it takes for the size of the system to double. Exponential growth is characterized by having a constant doubling time, which also sounds fairly harmless until one realizes that it implies, for example, that it would take the same time for a population to double from 10,000 to 20,000, thereby adding just 10,000 people, as it would for it to double from 20 million to 40 million. Thereby adding a humongous 20 million people. Amazingly, the doubling time of the global population has actually been getting systematically shorter and shorter, as was indicated earlier. It took 300 years from 1500 to 1800 for the population to double from 500 million to a billion, but only 120 years to double to 2 billion, and only another 45 to double again to 4 billion. So, Until relatively recently, we have been increasing at an accelerating pace that is actually faster than a pure exponential. Although this acceleration has begun to slow down over the past 50 years, we are still effectively growing at an exponential rate. Rather than presenting more definitions and dry statistics, I want to relate a couple of amusing stories that illustrate these ideas more vividly. The surprising attractions and pitfalls of exponential growth have been well known for a long time, especially in the East, where compound interest has been understood and used since ancient times. This is illustrated in one of the great epic poems in world literature, the Shahnameh, written about 1,000 years ago by the revered Persian poet Ferdowsi. It is the world's longest epic poem and took 30 years to write. Around the time it was being written, chess was introduced to Persia from India, where it had been invented. With its rise to popularity, Ferdowsi memorialized it using the chessboard as a means of illustrating the implications of exponential growth. Here's a version of the story. When the inventor of chess showed the game to the king, the ruler was so taken by it that he asked the inventor to name his reward for creating such a marvelous and challenging game. The man, who was mathematically inclined, asked the king for what seemed to be an extremely modest reward in the form of grains of rice. However, these were to be apportioned in the following manner. He would receive one grain of rice on the first square of the chessboard, 2 grains on the second, 4 on the third, 8 on the fourth, 16 on the fifth, and so on, doubling the amount for each progressive square. The king, though somewhat offended by such an apparently measly response to his very generous offer, reluctantly accepted the inventor's request and ordered the treasurer to count out the grains of rice as prescribed by the inventor. However, when the treasurer had not completed the assignment by the end of the week, the king called him to task and asked him the reason for his extreme tardiness. The treasurer responded by telling the king that it would take more than the entire sum of all the assets in his kingdom to give the inventor his reward. Let's examine why the treasurer's response is not only correct, but is in fact a gross underestimate of the size of the reward. It's actually a pretty simple argument. Recall that a chessboard is made up of 64 squares, 8 times 8. The instructions for determining the reward are that there is to be just 1 grain of rice on the first square, 2 on the second, 4 on the third, and so on. So, on the 8th square, for example, the one in the top right-hand corner of the board, there are 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 equals 128 grains. However, by the time we get to the last square, that is, the 64th, which is in the bottom right-hand corner of the board, the number of grains of rice is determined by multiplying 63 twos together. That is, 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 63 times. This is a truly astronomical number. If you carry this out on the calculator on your laptop or smartphone, you will quickly confirm that it's 9,223,372,372,854,775,808, which is just a little under 10 million trillion grains of rice. This amount of rice would form a pile larger than Mount Everest. This illustrates the fantastic power and ultimate absurdity of unchecked exponential growth. It also illustrates some of its unsuspecting characteristics. It starts out surprisingly slowly, but once unleashed, gets completely out of control, gobbling up everything before it. Furthermore, at any one time, the size of an exponentially growing population is larger than the sum of all the individuals that existed before it. For example, the number of grains on any single square is always larger than the sum of all of the grains on all of the other previous squares added together. Thus, there are more people alive on the planet today than all of the people that have lived from the beginning of the exponential explosion until now. So reaching a potentially unsustainable population, or a seemingly infinite one, comes upon the system quite unexpectedly, as our next cautionary tale aptly demonstrates. As I will discuss later, in naturally occurring communities that go through a stage of exponential expansion, such as forests and bacterial colonies, there are typically natural feedback mechanisms that lead to ecological limits to growth, often related to competitive forces and environmental resource constraints. Which brings me to my second cautionary tale, which contains a Talmudic sort of question. The story is in the form of a fictional thought experiment inspired by the real-life process of growing bacterial colonies. Suppose we want to prepare a sample of an antibiotic, such as penicillin, and start the process with a single bacterium, which, for the sake of argument, we know splits into two identical daughter bacteria every minute. So, after 1 minute we have two bacteria, each of which splits into two new bacteria after another minute, giving us four. Another minute later we have 8, then 16, and so on, doubling the number with each successive minute. The analogy to the exponential growth of rice grains on the chessboard is obvious. Suppose we start the growth process at 8 o'clock in the morning, and have carefully calculated that there are just sufficient nutrients to ensure that the container is completely filled with bacteria by exactly 12 noon. Here's the question. At what time between 8 a.m. and noon is the container half full? Those who get the wrong answer typically suggest a time over halfway between 8 o'clock and 12 o'clock, such as 10:30 or 11:15. The correct answer, which comes as a surprise to some, is 11:59, just 1 minute before noon. I'm sure you've got it. Since the population doubles every minute, it must have been half of its final size just 1 minute before the process ends at noon, which is 11:59 a.m. I'd like to take this little thought experiment one step further by paradoxically working backward. 1 minute before noon, the container is half full. 2 minutes before noon, it's only a quarter full. A half times a half. 3 minutes before noon, it's 1/8 full. A half times a half times a half, and so on. At 11:55 a.m., just 5 minutes before noon, the container is only 1/32 full. A half times a half times a half times a half times a half. It is only about 3% full, with the bacteria barely being visible. Proceeding in this way, a similar calculation shows that at 11:50 a.m., with only 10 minutes remaining, the container is only 0.1% full, and therefore looks empty. So, for almost the entire lifetime of this little universe, the container appears empty with almost nothing happening in it, even though the colony is continuing to grow exponentially during the entire time. Only in the last few minutes, corresponding to a tiny fraction of its entire existence, and just before this bacterial universe comes to an oblivious end, is there any visible action in the container? Now, let's look at this from the point of view of the bacteria living in the colony. Even after 100 generations, which is equivalent to 100 minutes in real time, corresponding to roughly 2,000 years in human time, assuming 20 years for each human generation, life is wonderful, food is abundant, and the community is continuing to expand and colonize their little universe. Even after 200 generations, all seems to be going famously well. And even after 235 generations, it still looks pretty good, although a few of the bacteria may already have become conscious of the boundaries of their universe and perceived for the first time that food is beginning to get a little scarce. Very shortly thereafter, at 239 doublings, when the population has reached the absurdly huge number of 10 to the 71st, that is a trillion multiplied by itself a million times, are things beginning to look very bad for everyone. And indeed, just one generation later, it's all over. Although the details of this little fable are not quite right, bacterial doubling times are typically more like 30 minutes rather than 1 minute, and more important, effects such as the production of toxic wastes and consequent cellular mortality have been ignored, the basic message and implications of unrestrained exponential growth are for real. Rapid growth, followed by stagnation and collapse. Crucial in this is that the system is closed, meaning that the resources available to the colony have been kept finite, as in the test tube story I just related above. Pointedly, this is analogous to the closed situation we have engineered for ourselves on Earth, with our almost total reliance on fossil fuels rather than remaining open and being powered externally by the sun. While exponential growth is a remarkable manifestation of our extraordinary accomplishments as a species, built into it are the potential seeds of our demise and the portent of big troubles just around the next corner. 4. The rise of the industrial city and its discontents. I have presented these somewhat provocative cautionary tales both to illustrate the meaning and implications of open-ended exponential growth, and to set the stage for a later discussion on global sustainability. It's hard not to view them anthropocentrically as the epic saga of modern man that is destined to end tragically and relatively precipitously in much the same unsuspecting way that it did for the bacteria. Are these stories realistic metaphors for what we've been doing over the last 200 years? Should we be preparing for the worst, or, at the very least, changing our profligate ways? Or are these just mythical fables that are misleading in their simplicity, and will humans continue on their journey toward an even more glorious future of health, wealth, and prosperity? Questions such as these have fueled a highly spirited, ongoing debate that began very soon after the Industrial Revolution set the wheels of exponential growth in motion, and has continued right up to the present time. The transition from working the land and artisanal hand production to automated machines and the creation of factories for the mass production of goods, the technological innovation and increased productivity in agriculture, the introduction of new chemical manufacturing and iron production processes, the improved efficiency of water power, and the increasing use of steam fueled by the change from renewable wood energy to fossilized coal energy, all contributed to an inevitable migration of more and more people away from a traditional rural existence to the rapidly expanding urban centers that were perceived as providing greater opportunities for employment. This process continues unabated across the globe to this day. The huge changes wreaked by the Industrial Revolution created many wealthy entrepreneurial manufacturers and factory owners, and saw the rise of a sizable and increasingly influential middle class. But the fate of the newly urbanized working class, whether in factories or mines, was pretty abysmal. Think of the Dickensian image of Oliver Twist's London, a city pervaded by crime, pollution, disease, and destitution, with a large working-class population living in misery. Slums, which arose as a response to a rapid population growth and industrialization, were notoriously overcrowded with unsanitary and squalid living conditions. In many ways, it was Manchester, the hub of the booming textile industry, and consequently a major driver of British ambitions to rule the waves in order to ensure supplies of raw materials such as cotton, that was the true symbol of the Industrial Revolution. It was the world's first industrial city, and grew by a factor of 6 from a population of little more than 20,000 in 1771 to 120,000 in 1831, and to more than 2 million by the end of the 19th century, nearly 70 years later. The evolution of Manchester provided the template that has been repeated innumerable times across the globe right up to the present day, from Dusseldorf and Pittsburgh to Shenzhen and Sao Paulo. Looking back on megacities of the past, such as London or New York, we recognize that they suffered from much the same negative image often associated with megacities of today, such as Mexico City, Nairobi, or Calcutta. This is how Manchester's textile workers were described 150 years ago. The notorious fact is that well-constitutioned men are rendered old and past labor at 40 years of age, and that children are rendered decrepit and deformed, and thousands upon thousands of them slaughtered by consumptions, tuberculosis, before they arrive at the age of 16. Nevertheless, despite the shameless exploitation and terrible dehumanizing living and working conditions, these cities became highly mobile, rapidly evolving diverse societies, offering huge opportunities that ultimately resulted in many of them becoming drivers of the world's economy. Much the same could be speculated about megacities emerging today in Africa, Asia, and other parts of the world. To quote the American architect and urban planner Andres Duany, in 1860, the capital city of Washington, with a population of 60,000, had unlighted streets, open sewers, and pigs roaming about its principal avenues. This condition was worse than the worst of our current cities. There is hope. I cannot resist inserting a small personal note when writing about the rise of Victorian megacities and the plight of the working poor. Although I was born in a rural area of England, the county of Somerset, I have family roots in the East End of London, and by a strange twist of fate, ended up attending the last several years of my high school there. The East End is a product of the rapid expansion of London during the 19th century, and became one of the poorest, most overcrowded areas of the city, and, consequently, a breeding ground for disease and crime. The infamous Jack the Ripper was perhaps the most notorious East End criminal of all time. In keeping with this dubious tradition, my deskmate who sat next to me in class for my first 2 years at that high school eventually became the most wanted criminal in Britain. At that time, much of the East End was still referred to as a slum and still oozed a Dickensian ambience, especially in the winter months when the days were short, the skies dark grey, and classic swirling pea-soup fogs descended on the city. The perfect setting for a Sherlock Holmes mystery. During the summers, up through college, I worked as a labourer in local breweries. My first experience was in the summer of 1956, when I was 15 years old. It was at the old Taylor Walker's Brewery in Limehouse, at that time a particularly disreputable part of the East End, adjacent to the docks on the north bank of the Thames. Limehouse has featured in many books and films, and had remained relatively unchanged from its Victorian past. In 1956, it still had a reputation for crime, though the opium dens of Dickens's The Mystery of Edwin Drood were long gone. The brewery, which dated from 1730, was built in 1827 and partially revamped in 1889. It was a typical Victorian red brick factory building, with poor lighting and ventilation, and pretty awful working conditions that had remained much the same for more than 100 years. My job consisted of continuously and mindlessly loading crates of beer bottles onto a vertical conveyor belt that took the used bottles to be cleaned and refilled with beer. Every 5 seconds or so, another heavy crate had to be fed to this ancient iron machine, relentlessly, for 9.5 hours a day, 5.5 days a week. This included an hour's overtime each day, as well as for the half day on Saturday, with an hour's break for lunch and a 15-minute break in the morning and afternoon. This was the hardest work I have ever done in my life, except possibly for string theory, and helping to guide the Santa Fe Institute through the market meltdown of 2008. I would return home, almost an hour away, exhausted, eat a huge meal, and be asleep by 8:30 p.m. and up at 6:30 the next morning. During the breaks, a man with a grubby old body-length leather apron emerged from the pages of Dickens, carrying a large, dirty iron bucket with an old, beaten-up pewter mug attached to it by an iron chain. The bucket contained Taylor Walker's cheapest brown ale, and we were privileged to have as much of it to drink as we wished using the pewter mug. Needless to say, the mug was neither cleaned nor rinsed between uses. God knows what diseases I caught, and I certainly didn't mention any of this to my mum. For all of this, I got paid 1 shilling 11¾ pence an hour, which is almost a tenth of a pound, 10p in today's coinage, or roughly 15 US cents. This is not quite as bad as it sounds. Inflated to today's value, it corresponds to approximately £2.18, or roughly $3 an hour. This was actually pretty good for a 15-year-old, and I earned enough during those 2 or 3 months of the summer to fund a modest hitchhiking holiday and to enjoy what London could offer an adolescent boy for the rest of the year. But if I had been a 30-year-old man with a wife and 3 children, goodness knows how I would have made ends meet, even if I were being paid twice as much. Conditions and prospects were extremely poor, though no doubt they were an improvement from 50 or 100 years earlier, when the workday was 12 hours long, 6 days a week, and children were routinely used as labor in mines and manufacturing. I was politically conservative, but like many before me, was strongly affected by what I witnessed in the big city at both ends of the economic spectrum, from Marx and Engels to George Bernard Shaw and the Bloomsbury set, and to Clement Attlee and his post-war colleagues of the British Labour Party. Many thinkers from comfortable upper-middle-class backgrounds were shocked by the poverty and deprivation they saw in the East End of London, the mills of Lancashire, and the collieries of South Wales. It's easy to forget that harsh, unsanitary working conditions were the norm for many of the labouring class long before the Industrial Revolution. All of the sins we associate with the Industrial Revolution and urbanization were just as prevalent in pre-industrial society, whether it was child labor, dirty living conditions, or long working hours. Indeed, it was the improvements rendered by science and the Enlightenment that eventually contributed to the large decrease in infant and child mortality, and therefore to the rapid increase in the population growth rate. Life may appear worse for an urban industrial worker relative to his agricultural counterpart, partially because of the perceived dehumanizing harshness of factories and mines relative to working on the land, but also because the scale and extent of the problem was so much larger as a result of exponential expansion. Similar arguments persist today, when many believe that life was so much better when we all supposedly lived in small villages and towns where there was a sense of community and relatedness that today seems absent in the hubbub of the modern city. I will return to this later, when I discuss the dynamics of cities and show how an accelerating pace of life is integral to the idea of an open-ended growing economy that all of us have come to depend upon, whether we live in fast-track cities or sleepy rural villages. 5. Malthus, Neo-Malthusians, and the Great Innovation Optimists. Thomas Robert Malthus is usually credited with being the first person to recognize the potential threat posed by open-ended exponential growth and connected to the challenge of resource limitation and availability. Malthus was an English cleric and scholar and an early contributor to the newly emerging fields of economics and demography and their implications for long-term political strategy. He published a highly influential essay in 1798 titled An Essay on the Principle of Population, in which he declared that the power of population is indefinitely greater than the power in the earth to produce subsistence for man. His argument was that the population multiplies geometrically, meaning that it increases at an exponential rate, whereas the ability to grow and supply food increases only arithmetically, meaning that it increases at a much slower linear rate. So the size of the population will eventually outstrip the food supply, leading to catastrophic collapse. Malthus concluded that in order to avoid such a catastrophe and ensure a sustainable population, some form of population control was needed. This would either arise through natural causes, such as an increase in disease, starvation, and war, or, more preferably, by changing social behavior, particularly that of the working poor, whose reproductive rates he perceived as the apparent cause of the problem. Being a devout Christian, he didn't much like the idea of contraception, and preferred the concept of moral restraint such as abstinence, delayed marriages, and restricting marriage for those in dire poverty or with health or mental defects. Sound familiar? Given his deeply felt religious and moral beliefs, it's highly debatable whether Malthus would have been an enthusiastic supporter of mass sterilization or the freedom to obtain abortions had they been available at that time. However, he would surely have been a huge supporter of the one-child policy adopted by China. Needless to say, modern neo-Malthusians have no such religious scruples concerning artificial birth control, abortion, or possibly even sterilization programs, if they are on a voluntary basis. An unfortunate consequence of Malthus's analyses was that they were interpreted as effectively blaming the poor for their own predicament, because they persisted in reproducing too rapidly. It was relatively easy, therefore, to conclude that it was this, rather than exploitation by capitalists, that was the origin of their poverty and their generally abysmal condition. As a further consequence of his thinking, traditional Malthusians believed that paternalistic charity for the poor, whether governmental or philanthropic, was counterproductive, in that it resulted only in increasing their numbers, therefore contributing further to the exponential growth in the number of dependent poor,